Professor Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HallieKesserJane.com.
I'm going to say something which might sound startling. Israel is losing the battle for public opinion across the world for a very simple reason. Very difficult to accept, but very easy to prove. And Israel is losing the battle for world opinion across the globe because it doesn't want to win.
Welcome to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. I am Hallie Kesser-Jane. Thank you so much for tuning in. Nothing like a controversial statement to begin a show. And today on the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show, we bring you controversy in a provocative conversation with Jerusalem Post columnist and founder of the Israel Institute of Strategic Studies, Dr. Martin Sherman. Our subject, Israel, the nation-state of the Jewish people, the country no bigger than the tiny state of New Jersey, a mere 67 years old, and yet it commands as much attention as any. But before we begin, today, the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. And remember, The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show is always available online at HallieKesserJane.com and a host of venues including iHeartRadio, Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, and Blog Talk Radio. Columnist for the Jerusalem Post, Dr. Martin Sherman served for 7 years in operational capacities in the Israeli defense establishment. He was a ministerial advisor to Yitzhak Shamir's government and lectured for 20 years at Tel Aviv University in political science, international relations, and strategic studies. With a Bachelor of Science in Physics and Geology, an MBA in Finance, and a PhD in Political Science and International Relations, Sherman was the first academic director of the internationally renowned Herzliya Conference and is the author of 2 books and numerous articles and policy papers on a wide range of political, diplomatic, and security issues. Born in South Africa, Dr. Sherman has lived in Israel since 1971 and is currently involved in the Independent Policy Center, the Israel Institute of Strategic Studies. Let's talk.
So, Martin, is Israel's problem Israel? And by that I mean, is the country its own worst enemy? I mean, at every turn it seems to be provocative, seemingly taunting the President of the United States, the EU, the Palestinians. But listen to me. Or would it be more correct to say that what might appear as provocation is simply the fact that Israel refuses to live a lie and truth itself is provocative to those who can't see it? Where are you on that?
Well, let me go back to your first question when you asked if Israel is its own worst enemy. And my answer to that question is yes, but in completely the opposite sense that you've suggested. I think that Israel's greatest strategic failure and its greatest strategic challenge and perhaps its greatest strategic need is public diplomacy. Basically, if you look at the accumulation of Israeli achievement, it's really quite staggering. Israel is on the cutting edge of virtually every single activity in human endeavor, whether it's medicine, technology, communications, agriculture, etc., etc. The one thing that is a dismal failure is its public diplomacy in presenting its case. And, you know, I'm not an uncritic apologist for Netanyahu, although I have supported him on a number of occasions when I thought he was doing the right thing. Like, for instance, his address to Congress, I think it was the correct move, and I think it will pay off in the long run. But in general, Israel has been very, very reticent in putting its case forward in a robust and assertive manner. And so instead of actually placing itself in the right, it's been apologetic about most things. For instance, on the Palestinian issue. The Palestinian issue, for anyone who examines the historical truth of the matter and the political realities, must reach the conclusion that their claims are a giant hoax. The same thing with the clash with the American president, particularly on the Iranian issue. I mean, you know, anyone who has any affiliation with the generic values of Western culture must know that the deal being brewed with the tyrants of Tehran is very similar in principle, although different in detail, but very, very similar in principle to the Munich agreements that Chamberlain signed with the Nazis. You know, and that's not my opinion. That's even people, even previous Obama supporters like Alan Dershowitz have said that, and people in Israel who are not on the hard right, in fact, left center, are beginning to compare the deal with Chamberlain. So I think Israel's biggest failing, and why it's its own worst enemy, is that it hasn't invested either the resources or the energy or the creativity in presenting its case and conveying its true image to the world.
So let's hold off on that for a second, because I'm going to go into detail with you on that, because I think that point that you raise is brilliant, and I think that it's being missed by the appropriate people in Israel. But I'm going to take out something that I said first, add a little bit further. There is a war against Israel, and it's not war of rockets like it used to be, other than, you know, this little recent incursion with Gaza. But it's a war of words, and of movements, and in boycotts, a delegitimization, if you will, while we go ahead and, by the way, legitimize Iran. We did delegitimize Israel, which I find just bizarre, and let me take this out to where I want to go with it. Let's not forget anti-Semitism. I'm thinking BDS and apartheid, and consider the EU's new threat to label items coming out of the West Bank. I mean, the good guy Israel seems to somehow become the bad guy in the world's purview. How do you look at that? How do you talk about that? How do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, you know, I sort of feel a sense of indignation and even outrage. That I think that if you look for the source of much of the anti-Israel sentiment, you have to come back to a large portion of Israeli civil society elites, because nearly all Israel's detractors somehow come back and quote Israeli sources, whether it's an Israeli general or an Israeli professor or an Israeli poet. And so if you want to trace the real origin of and the fuel of the anti-Israeli tirade abroad, you have to come back to what I call a trinity of Israeli civil society elites, who have an agenda which, in my opinion, is completely at odds with the long-term national interests of the country. And they are imposing on the elected politicians, no matter who gets elected, a policy which has nothing to do with what they promised the electorate. You know, if you go back and you look at the last few elections here, Yitzhak Rabin was elected basically as a hawkish Labour candidate and ended up signing the Oslo agreements, much of which negated what he promised the electorate. Then you had Arik Sharon, who was the ultra-super hawk, and actually ran on a ticket opposing unilateral withdrawal. And when he got into power, without getting a renewed mandate from the voters, he actually imposed unilateral withdrawal on his party, which in general was against it. And then you even had Netanyahu, who was elected in 2009 on the ticket of opposing Palestinian statehood. And then at his Bar-Ilan speech in June 2009, actually agreed, albeit under certain reservations, agreed to the principle of Palestinian statehood.
Listen to what you're saying. What you're saying basically is, and I would let me impose this, American leadership imposes its will on Israel, European leadership imposes its will on Israel, and Israel capitulates, and you're saying, I suspect, that is the core of the problem, because Israel is not standing up to the people it needs to stand up to, correct?
No, I don't think, you know, if you look I would disagree on two points there. The first point that I would say, if you look at two of the most important processes that were implemented over the last two decades, A, the Oslo process and the withdrawal from Gaza and Judea and Samaria, and then the disengagement was, you know, with the unilateral withdrawal from the entire Gaza Strip. None of these were a product of international pressure. In fact, the PLO was still designated a terrorist organization deep into the negotiation period of Oslo. There was no real pressure from the American administration for Israel to recognize the PLO as a negotiating partner. That was an Israeli initiative, an Israeli dish cooked by Israeli chefs and served by Israeli waiters. It was the Oslo Agreement was not a result of international pressure. There was generic pressure for Israel to make concessions to the Palestinians. But anything as specific and as far-reaching as Oslo was never the product of international pressure. Even more so, the disengagement. Again, there was generic pressure for Israel to make concessions and meet some Palestinian demands. But there was no no American demand. In fact, the Americans are very skeptical about a unilateral withdrawal from the whole of Gaza. Those were concessions made by elected politicians because of the pressure of internal civil society elites, particularly Arik Sharon. If you remember, Arik Sharon was embroiled in legal problems. And in fact, you know, there's a very interesting program on primetime TV. And I'm not talking about right-wing pros. This is really, you know, mainstream Israel. And two left-wing journalists who studied the issue, one is Raviv Drucker, and the other one is, I'll remember his name in a minute. He's a member of parliament today. Shelach, also Shelach, who today is a member of parliament in the Yair Lapid's faction. They wrote a book about Arik Sharon. And they reached the conclusion that the whole disengagement was the product of Arik Sharon's assessment that if he did not make concessions to the Palestinians, he would be prosecuted. So basically, the withdrawal from Gaza was a sacrificial lamb thrown to left-wing elites to protect Arik Sharon from legal prosecution. Now, this is not my opinion. This is the opinion of two left-leaning journalists, primetime TV, wrote a book about it.
Well, then I'm going to go back to where I started with this. Is Israel its own worst enemy? And by what you say, yes is the answer to that.
My second point was, and I'm going to say something which might sound startling. Israel is losing the battle for public opinion across the world for a very simple reason. Very difficult to accept, but very easy to prove. And Israel is losing the battle for world opinion across the globe because it doesn't want to win.
Now, what?
Or at least the people charged with the conduct of Israel's public diplomacy have a world view which doesn't allow them to adopt a winning strategy. Now, as I said, you know, it sounds pretty startling. But I said it's easy to prove. How do you prove it? If you want to measure the motivation of an organization to achieve an objective, i.e. say, win the battle for world opinion, one of the most important measures to gauge that motivation are the amount of resources that you allot for attaining it. Now, if you look at the amount of resources that Israel allots for presenting its case in the world, for its public diplomacy, it's a joke, a bad joke, but a joke. It's literally less than what a medium to large-sized company in Israel spends on promoting fast foods and snacks. In other words, if you're not investing in conveying your message, there's very little reason for you to expect it to be conveyed. Now, it's not that there's no money available. Israel today has a GDP of $250 billion. It has a state budget of $100 billion. If Israel was to invest 1%, 1% of state budget, or 0.25% of GDP, that would be $1 billion.
Okay, fine. I get that. But here's the thing. Let me interject this because I think this is important. Is it that they don't want to do it for their own reasons, or is it they're too dumb?
No, it's, well, you know,
there is that.
About this before, but what I've developed to explain this is the limousine theory.
Right.
Why the limousine theory? Because in a limousine, you have a driver in official uniform and a smart cap, and he holds the wheel, and sometimes he tilts it right, and sometimes he tilts it left, and sometimes he accelerates, and sometimes he slows down, and sometimes he even changes lanes. So the uninformed observer might actually think he's in charge. But he's not. You can change the driver. You might change the style of driving. You might even change the route slightly, but you won't change the destination because the destination is determined by the occupants of the back seats. And that takes me back to what I said before about Israel's civil society elites. You have a trinity of unelected civil society elites who have both the ability and the motivation to impose an agenda on the elected politicians. It doesn't matter whether it's Rabin, Sharon, Netanyahu, anyone, irrespective of what they promised the electorate.
Who are these? Who are these people that you're talking about? Who are they? Name some names.
First of all, I'd like to identify the groups. It's the people who control the mainstream media, which is becoming a little less monopolized now because of internet and things like that, but it's still mainly the mainstream media. The people who control the illegal establishment and the people who control much of Israeli academia. Now, these are three interacting and interactive elites. The people who control the legal establishment can impede any assertive initiative that the elected politicians may or may not want to implement. Like, for instance, cutting off electrical power to Gaza so there won't be power to drive the lathes that machine the rockets that they fire at us, or to power the lighting so that they can tunnel their underground the underground burrows, or cut off the cement supply to Gaza so they won't have cement for their tunnels. There's always be some legal argument why this cannot be done.
But you basically have the same thing in Israel that the United States has, too. I mean, every democracy has that, where you have entrenched the media, the legal aspects, and they all can play havoc with any leader's objectives. I get that. But I want to take this a little bit further than this, because there's also this moral thing that's going on. Israel is once the bastion of morality that everybody held up. I'm thinking Leon Uris and Exodus, and we all believed so strongly, you know, that Israel was a miracle, and isn't that wonderful? Now you have Ari Shavit of the right-wing paper, Haaretz. I've had him on the show talking about his book, My Promised Land, and he tells a completely different story, Martin. I mean, his whole thing is perpetuating something very ugly. Israel is the cruel conqueror. But if we take what you're saying, which is take part of the GDP of Israel.
Ari Shavit is a prime example of the kind of elites that I'm talking about.
Right, I understand. That's why I named his name. But I'm saying to you that if you did what you said, which is take part of the GDP and put it towards a powerful, positive message out there to stop this delegitimization effort and this moral horror that they're trying to make Israel into on the world stage, where anti-Semitism, of course, is at the root of all of this evil, I think, and I'm sure you would agree with me. What then? Because you have the problem right in Israel itself, where, like in America, where we have the right wing versus the left wing, there's no in between anymore. How do you get there? How do you fix it?
That's true. I don't want to say that money is a sufficient condition for solving the problem. But it's certainly a necessary condition, because, you know, even today, even if Israel today were to leave in place its current diplomatic corps with their pidgin English and their poor grasp of the issues, but would just turn up the volume of their voice 10 or 20 or 100 times, they'd be heard more. You know, I spent a year teaching in Los Angeles at USC and another small university. There was no Israeli presence there at all. When they brought over Barghouti, Omar Barghouti, who's heading the BDS movement, and there was no one from the embassy there to challenge him. When he brought along the Amnesty report accusing Israel of using water as a tool of apartheid and ethnic cleansing, there was no one there. Actually, this is an interesting story. Perhaps I'll just go into it.
Mm.
I just arrived in Los Angeles, and soon after I came, Omar Barghouti arrived, brandishing this Amnesty report accusing Israel, as I said, of using water as a tool for ethnic cleansing and apartheid, and depriving the Palestinians of their fair share of water. And someone from the local Stand With Us branch asked me, now water is something that I happen to know about, apart from the fact that I have a degree in physics and geology, which gives me a fair idea of how water behaves in rock. I also worked with the Ministry of Agriculture. I was advised to the Ministry of Agriculture when water was, at that time, was under the auspices of the ministry. And I wrote a book on the water issue. So I have a good grasp of the realities. And when he arrived, I tried to contact the consulate. And I said, look, I've got all the figures. You know, what they're saying is completely baseless. By any criteria that you want to choose, whether it's total consumption of fresh water, per capita consumption of fresh water, consumption of water relative to Israelis, the size of the agricultural product, the area of agricultural irrigation, number of houses hooked up to running water, the situation of the Palestinians has improved beyond all recognition, far beyond other countries in the Arab world. Okay, so I said, you know, why don't we produce a paper, preemptive paper, that cuts the ground from under Barghouti's feet? Anyway, I got no response from the consulate. I went to his lecture, which was a tirade of lies, distortions, half-truths, etc., etc. You couldn't ask interactive questions, so I didn't bother. I went back to my apartment, and I wrote an article for the Jerusalem Post, and I produced a PowerPoint presentation, which actually refutes every claim that Barghouti raised. And I sent it to the Water Authority here in Israel. And they said, this is great, you know, we'd like to put it on our website. Can you translate it into Hebrew? And I said, yes, sure. You know, I did a lot of work on it myself. Of course, pro bono telephone calls to Israel, back and forth at my own expense. And eventually we we got together a product which the Water Authority thought was appropriate for their website, and the Minister of Infrastructure at that time was Uzi Landau, approved it. And I say it doesn't go up on the website, and I ask why, and I say, well, the head of the Water Authority is someone with close ties with Peace Now, the left-wing peace movement, and he doesn't want to do anything that might upset the Palestinians. So telling the truth is no longer admissible because it may upset the Palestinians.
Well, politics, politics, politics. There you go, buddy. It's not always so black and white, is it?
Because in spite of the fact that the elected politician, i.e. the minister, approved it, the unelected bureaucrats stopped it.
Well, there you go. I have to change because I'm watching the clock. And we've got to get to the first of all, to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Martin, the idea that if Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian issue were to be resolved, that the Middle East would become somehow this bastion of a utopia, which is the huge argument you hear now from the EU and from the United States. Give me a break. Are you buying that?
Well, of course, so you have to be totally disingenuous to,
just
to even suggest that. I mean, you know, if you look at Middle Eastern, or what they call MENA, the Middle East and North Africa, you know, from Algeria across to the Persian Gulf. Yeah, the whole country, the whole area is engulfed in violence and slaughter and genocide in many places. So Algeria itself was up until recently in the throes of a really vicious civil war. You have Libya, of course, now, which is descending into chaos. We have Tunisia, even Tunisia, which once was the poster child of the Arab Spring, is also sliding somewhat more slowly towards Islamic control. You have Egypt, which at the moment with Sisi is still holding out, but it's also teetering on the brink. And I think the elephant in the room with Egypt that no one's really talking about is the dam that the Ethiopians are building on the Blue Nile. And once that becomes used for irrigation, Egypt will be doomed.
Right.
Then you have Sudan, of course, the slaughter in Sudan. And going across to Syria and ISIS in Iraq, the Iranian regime, Yemen. None of this had any remote connection to the Palestinian issue. And in fact, if Israel were to withdraw its presence from Judea and Samaria, there would be very similar to reality in Judea and Samaria. I mean, the only thing preventing the Palestinian areas descending into chaos and bloodshed is the Israeli presence there. So the claim is totally ridiculous, and I don't think today anyone could actually raise it unless they're being totally disingenuous.
So here's the deal. So there is this problem out there because it looks like this thing is starting to get on Obama's radar once again, and he wants to see about bringing the folks back to the table. Two-state solution. How long have they been trying to get this going?
In the century.
When does some creative politician jump out and say, stop this, it's never going to work, it is not the solution, let's try something else? What's the something else they can try? You have an idea. I think it's a good one. Talk to me.
Yeah, well, first of all, you're quite right. And again, the fact that Israel has been so inept in presenting its case, especially on U.S. campuses, has let the two-state solution basically monopolize the debate, with the fallback position being basically the threat of a multi-ethnic one-state solution, which would wash away the Jewish majority. But you know, I think what's happened recently, up until recently, the left or the two-staters were challenging the opponents of the two-state solution, saying, "Well, what's your alternative?" And the mainstream opposition to the two-state always had managing the conflict. Of course, you can't manage the conflict because the status quo is continually deteriorating for Israel. If you look at what Yitzhak Rabin suggested in his last speech in the Knesset as his vision for a permanent settlement with the Palestinians, and you look at what Bibi Netanyahu was suggesting today, what Bibi Netanyahu is suggesting today is far more concessionary than what the peace laureate Rabin was suggesting. So you can't manage the situation. Recently, some opponents of the two-state solution on what's called the Israeli right, I don't really like the terms left and right, I think it's more a matter of doves and hawks, have suggested some solutions which, in my opinion, are perhaps more dangerous than the two-state solution, whether it's Naftali Bennett's idea of partial annexation of Judea and Samaria, just annexing Area C, or even my colleague Caroline Glick, who suggests annexing the territory and offering the Arab residents their permanent residency. I think those are both very dangerous proposals. What I'm suggesting is a little different. Some people think it's more radical. I don't think it is, because for Israel to survive as the nation state of the Jewish people, it has to address adequately two imperatives. The first imperative is the geographic imperative, and the second is the demographic imperative. In addressing these imperatives, it faces two mortal dangers, the two-state solution and the one-state solution. The two-state solution doesn't address the geographic imperative because it will leave Israel's metropolis totally defenseless. And the one-state solution doesn't address the demographic imperative because even if the optimistic demographers are correct and Israel will still be able to maintain a majority over a very large Arab minority, you would not be able to maintain the Jewish nature of the state. If you have a Muslim minority of 35% to 40%, you will not be able to have the Star of David on the flag. You would not be able to have the same words for the national anthem. Saturday is the day of rest, etc., etc. It would be completely impossible to maintain the status of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people in terms of the conduct of public life, etc., etc. The only way to do that is somehow reduce the Arab presence within the frontiers of what Israel administers today between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. If you want to do this, you can either do it coercively, which will be very difficult to justify internationally, or non-coercively, which I suggest doing with economic inducements. Now, people say this won't work. Well, I beg to differ. If you look what's happening in Gaza today, people are actually paying to leave. They're not getting money to leave. They're paying to leave because conditions there are so bad. So what I'm suggesting is Israel declare the Palestinians what the Palestinians themselves declare they are, the enemy. Stop supporting their economy. Stop giving them water, electrical power, postal services, fuel, tax collection services, port services. And to prevent the humanitarian catastrophe that would inevitably bring about, offer individual non-belligerent Palestinians relocation grants that will make them desirable immigrants in a large number of countries across the world.
Can I just interrupt here? Because I so love this idea on a number of levels, but it's really just a reverse of what happened in Gaza, where the Israelis withdrew. Now you're saying you guys withdraw. Here's my thing to you. The Arab countries, and the Palestinians are not Palestinians. If anything, they're just plain old Arabs with a new name. Why are the Arabs off the hook on dealing with their own people, particularly Jordan, where the king's wife is a Palestinian herself? Why are they allowed to get away with this? Why is it always on Israel to problem?
I go back to what I said because Israel is not going on the offensive in terms of public diplomacy. It could do that. But again, you know, my plan is not necessarily for them to resettle in Arab countries. You know, there are 500,000 Palestinians in South America, most of them Christian, but there's little 500,000 Palestinians in South America. I once presented this plan to an Indian member of parliament, you know, and he said to me, "This is very interesting. I haven't thought of this before. Tell me, how many Palestinians are there? And I said, "You know, there's a fierce argument about how many there are, but you know, no one thinks there's more than 5 million. So I said, 5 million, is that all? We could take them. It sounds a bit daunting at the beginning, but if you look at it in global terms, the problem is basically trivial. There are 250 million migrants in the world today, most of whom are motivated by economic considerations. So if every year 100 to 200,000 Palestinians were to migrate, it wouldn't even be a blip on the radar. And you know, within a decade and a half, you would have basically solved the problem. You would have alleviated all the Palestinian suffering. You would have left Israel with secure borders and strategic assets that it needs. Palestinians would arrive at host countries as relatively wealthy immigrants, and the host countries would benefit by huge capital influxes. You know, I can give you an unrealistic but illustrative example. Let's suppose all the Palestinians, let's say there were 3 million Palestinians, which would be in the neighborhood of about 800,000 families, were to go to Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, and Indonesia were to open its gates to the Palestinians. What would be the result of this, apart from the facts that Israel would retain its vital strategic assets? Each Palestinian arriving at the gates of Indonesia would have anything between 7 decades to a century's worth of GDP per capita in Indonesian terms, the equivalent of someone arriving in the United States of something like $3 million. The population of Indonesia would be increased by barely 1%. And Indonesia, we get an influx of capital, almost $200 billion. It sounds like win-win to me.
Well, it is, except that then you have to ask the other side of that question, which is why are the leading world leaders so invested in this two-state solution versus investing as a new... Remember when we had leaders who had great ideas and they weren't afraid to put them out and try that? There's an investment in the two-state solution, whether it's a psychological investment or it's a political investment, but you can't get people off the mark. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen for one of the most failed policies ever. Long term.
You're 100% right. And that's why, with all due modesty, I think voices like mine need to be amplified.
Well, that's why you're on my show.
I thank you very much. But this brings me back to another problem. If you look at the philanthropy on the left and the right, I don't want to sort of, so it's not really a level playing field, because left-wing organizations have access to funds which right-wing organizations don't, like EU funding, etc., etc. But if you look at the private market, left-wing benefactors have invested in mechanisms and frameworks to advance agendas, like J Street, like the New Israel Fund, like Peace Now. Right-wing benefactors tend to invest in things like real estate, housing, charities, fire engines. And if you want to raise $50,000 for a new dairy in one of the outposts in Judea and Samaria, there's no problem raising it. But if you want to raise $50,000 to impact the political discourse, their eyes glaze over. They don't understand it. The right-wing benefactors want to see facts on the ground. But in this particular struggle, facts on the ground mean nothing if they don't have ideological supports. And you know, the most vivid example of that is what happened in Gaza. In Gaza, you had nearly a quarter of a century, more than a quarter of a century presence of Israeli settlements on the ground. Billions of dollars invested by donors in synagogues and recreation centers and clinics, etc., etc. And they were all wiped off the face of the earth because they lost the ideological argument. You know, I had a discussion with a very big right-wing donor who was very complimentary about what I was doing, but she said she couldn't support me. And I said, why? I said, because we're buying properties in East Jerusalem. I said, no, you know, you can buy hundreds of properties in East Jerusalem, but if there's a political decision to divide the city, the fact that Jews have legal title to some of the properties in East Jerusalem is not going to change anything. The next regime will either allow them to keep their property or confiscate it. It's not going to have any impact on the Jews. Unless you can delegitimize the very idea of dividing Jerusalem, it makes no difference whether you buy properties or not. It's going to have impact on the outcome. And what's happened is that right-wing philanthropic funds have been sucked off and invested in causes which each cause by itself, you know, might sound very meritorious. But even if they're wildly successful, they're not going to have any impact on the strategic ideological argument, which is the only thing that can save Israel.
That's pretty bizarre. What are you calling your initiative?
Well, my organization is called the Israel Institute for Strategic Studies, which is an American-based 501c3.
But this concept of what you want to do in this new, instead of a two-state solution, what are you calling it?
So that's, we've called that the humanitarian paradigm, because basically it is humanitarian. We don't believe there's going to be any political solution. I don't think you can find any Arab collective will come to an agreement with Israel that will be anything other than Israeli surrender. So what I'm suggesting is to depoliticize the context. Otherwise, it's not a political problem. It's a humanitarian problem. The problem, the Palestinians are living in dire circumstances. Let's not treat them as a collective. Let's treat them as a group of faith-stricken individuals. And what we want to do is improve the humanitarian conditions by allowing them to seek a better life for themselves elsewhere, out of harm's way, and free from the control of the cruel, corrupt cliques who have led them astray for decades.
So let me make this point to you, Martin, that I think is like really important. It's not just a naming. It is a reality. These people's humanitarian conditions, mostly because of their own leadership, is pitiful. Pitiful. And that is not something that is dealt with in the press. It's just not sexy to blame their own leadership at this point. I want to have you back on the show to further flesh this out at another date, but we have other issues that I want to get to, and I'm watching the clock, so play with me here. And I want to talk to you, first of all, about Benjamin Netanyahu, who has, I'll tell you, he's a lightning rod. Obama hates him. Part of the right in the United States loves him. He has endured. He has Obama put every piece of machinery he had to get him out of office, and he won again. What are your thoughts on Mr. Netanyahu?
Well, you know, as I said before, I'm not an uncritical apologist for Netanyahu. I have severe criticisms of some of the things he's done, but I also have a deep appreciation of things he has. Some of the things he's done as well. I think he's an extraordinarily talented individual. I think he has a very impressive breadth and depth of knowledge over a wide range of topics. I don't think there's anyone in the current Israeli polity who could really compete with him pound for pound. To compare Herzog to him is a joke.
Oh, for sure.
On the other hand, I think his biggest failing is that despite the fact that he's been in power for almost half a decade, he's done nothing, absolutely nothing, to establish mechanisms and frameworks to help him deal with the kind of pressures he's been subjected to. As I said, going back to what I said before, if Israel had invested $100 million, which Israel's nothing really, $100 million for Israel is a joke, $100 million in an assault, a public diplomacy assault across U.S. campuses, because we're losing the next generation of leaders in the United States, even among the evangelical Christians who've been traditionally strong supporters of Israel. The support is being eroded away because of a dysfunctional foreign ministry. The foreign ministry has got no stomach for the fight because most of the diplomats in Israel's foreign ministry belong to the civil society elites that I mentioned before, and they have a worldview which doesn't allow them to adopt a winning strategy. Because to adopt a winning strategy, you have to go on the offensive. To go on the offensive, you have to present the Palestinians as they really are, a cruel, brutal, backward society that oppresses their women, suppresses their homosexuals, and represses political dissidents. It's because no religious tolerance, gender discrimination, political harassment of opponents, etc., etc. But if you present the Palestinians as they really are, it makes no sense to give them a state which will abut the main the Trans-Israel Highway that would overlook your only international airport, that would sit atop vital water resources for Israel, that would put most of Israel's civilian population and most of Israel's economic activity within weapons being used today, within the range of weapons being used today from territory that Israel has abandoned.
So what you're basically saying about Netanyahu is he's not creative?
No, I'm saying
he's not.
He's not resolute. He hasn't gone on the offensive. If you look at what's happened with Netanyahu since he's been elected, that people say he's annoying Obama. You know, I really beg to differ because I can't remember any politician who is bent over backwards trying to assuage the American administration and going against his own political base. You should remember Netanyahu in 2009 was elected in opposition to setting up a Palestinian state. And yet he bowed to Obama's wishes. And he needed to accept a Palestinian state. Then he accepted this unprecedented settlement construction freeze. And then he agreed to apologize to Turkey for Israeli commandos defending themselves against crazed terrorists who wanted to disembowel them.
So what's going on here? What is going on here? Is Obama just anti-Israel, anti-Semitic? Is Netanyahu weak when it comes to...
Netanyahu's weak. Netanyahu's weak with that. You know, I was really surprised that he stood up so well with his speech in Congress. You know, I wouldn't have been at all surprised if he'd backed down. In fact, I was slightly surprised that he didn't, because there was tremendous pressure on him from Israel, tremendous pressure. You know, people said it was all an electoral ploy. It really wasn't, because you know, he was so criticized in the media here for insisting on going. If anything, it hurt his electoral chances. You know what? If he had been if the election had been held after the Senate vote lost on Tuesday, I think his popularity here would have soared much more. He would have got better electoral results.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I never understood the press's argument that it helped him. It hurt him, if anything.
Yeah.
It didn't
yeah.
help him, and it took a lot of courage for him to do that, and he was stepping out of something else. So maybe one of the things, and I want to get to Iran in a second, but I think one of the things that crosses my mind in all of this is you can't read Netanyahu. You don't know what he's going to go for and what he's not going to go for. And it makes and generally speaking, you wonder whether or not he really isn't for a two-state solution. And he just, you know, he puts the fight up in public and then he acquiesces because that's what he really wants. I mean, that's what he said at the university speech, right?
Well, I don't think Netanyahu really wants a two-state solution, but I think he might, you know, I can envision scenarios where he may give in to it. I think that Netanyahu hasn't really built around himself a mechanism, a support mechanism. He's in many ways doesn't trust people enough to support him in the long term. You know, he's a little like a solo singer who's missing an orchestra.
Well, this is interesting. Interesting. You'll get this. Obama is the same way. He can't make pals in Congress. For this, he's a lone wolf.
Yeah. So, you know, Senator Netanyahu can go and you know, make brilliant speeches at the UN or in Congress and get standing ovations, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no follow-up. There's no follow-up because he hasn't got the apparatus there to reap the results of his great oratory. And so it gets dissipated, you know. And by the way, abroad, Netanyahu gets much better receptions of his speeches than he does in the Israeli media, because by and large, the Israeli media are very anti-Netanyahu. So, and that sort of inhibits him. But he hasn't built around himself a cadre of people who can take up his message and promote it forcefully on a global scale.
Yeah, it's a shame. Let's get to Iran. And I'm curious, before we get into it into the weeds, do you oppose trying to reach a diplomatic solution with Iran? Is it a waste of time?
The only diplomatic solution you can get to the Iran is to force them to come to the negotiating table because of crippling sanctions, as more or less happened. But that has to be backed up by a credible threat of military action. I don't think you can probably reach a political agreement with them, but it will never hold water. The Iranians will never honor it. They'll certainly not in the long run. They'll use it merely to advance their program. At least that must be the working assumption. I don't think that you can reach a consensual arrangement with it. It has to be coercive.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily have to be kinetic. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to attack them. You just have to make sure that the Iranians believe that you will.
Well, right. I think one of the things that's so interesting to me on this is because I read both the Israeli press and I read the American press. And the American press has been remiss on one huge aspect of this, and that is in describing just how huge a geopolitical shift an agreement such as this, whether it can be verified or not, but assuming it will be made, will be on not just the Middle East, but worldwide. And you don't get a lot of that conversation. You get a head scratch every time a little blurb on that concept comes out. I think that from Israel's point of view, they understand that, obviously, more than the Americans do. And I think Obama doesn't care, frankly, whether there is a geopolitical shift in power, be it in the Middle East or anywhere else. I'm curious of where you are on that. Do you understand the ramifications of such a deal and what it would mean, not just to Israel, but to the world at large?
Well, yeah, of course. I think I think that's one thing that the Israeli left even understands. You know, and that was my disappointment with the way Netanyahu's domestic rivals behaved here. Because you know, there are many things you can agree or disagree with Netanyahu on, but on the issue of Iran, everybody should have been fully behind him, and that would have stopped much of the bipartisanism in the United States. because the dissension in Israel was exploited for dissension abroad. If Israel had presented a united front to the American administration, it would have been very difficult for them to criticize Netanyahu the way they did. But of course, you know, the agreement is going to have many unforeseen ones and some foreseen consequences, like, you know, people are predicting that it will ignite a nuclear arms race across the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, as a Sunni country, will want the bomb. Turkey will probably want the bomb. Egypt, if it can muster resources, might launch a program like that as well. You know, the things with Obama, the scary thing about Obama is when you look at his policy across the Middle East, you don't know whether the results reflect failure or success. You're not sure that the results you're seeing actually represent a failure of his policy, or that's exactly what he wanted to happen.
Sorry, I have to laugh at that because that's so true. I mean, and frankly, if you were talking to a lot of the media here on the right wing, they would say he had a goal, and he's accomplishing his goal, and his goal is not pretty.
Yeah, it's really scary because, you know, there was really a good article in the Wall Street Journal recently by Henry Kissinger and George Shultz.
Yeah, fabulous.
Who really put their finger on it. What they said is basically, you know, Obama keeps saying that, you know, that all options are on the table. But basically, by saying we have to accept this agreement because the alternative is war, means that you've taken the military option off the table because you're not prepared to do it. Now, if you're shying away from the alternative is war, then what are you going to do when the Iranians violate the agreement? You can't do anything because the alternative is war. So the whole thing is so badly structured. And they were right. They said, you know, originally, backed by six UN resolutions, the aim was to prevent Iran acquiring nuclear capability. But they've gone from preventing Iran acquiring nuclear capability to managing or containing its ability. And so there's been a huge sea change in the approach to the Iranian issue.
I don't think it was a sea change. I actually think that was what his goal was in the first place. I don't think.
From before the Obama.
Right, I get that. But that's a Republican and that's a Democrat. And I don't think that the Democrat administration ever had any other idea other than the one that it's going to now. It wanted detente. I think between the neocons, let's say, quote unquote, and this administration. So that's what I don't think anybody should be surprised what he's done. He said it right, Payne, what he had in mind, his first campaign in 2008.
Well, I think, you know, the thing is, you know, that's, I've been warning about this before when I wrote about electing Obama, or certainly re-electing Obama. I think he's got a completely different perception of American interests.
Yes, he does.
I don't think that he would view an ascendant Muslim Brotherhood as something inimical to American interests, and you can see that by his behavior
in Egypt,
Cairo,
right,
when he insisted that the Muslim Brotherhood be seated in the front row against the express wishes of his host, Mubarak.
Right. So let me take this out with you. Netanyahu's right here. You wrote about it last week. Mm-hmm. Brilliant piece in your column, Into the Fray, In the Fray. Okay. In the Jerusalem Post, and everybody should go online and find it and read it. Fact of the matter is, even with the deal that was cut with Congress, I'm going to say to you, the fact they cannot stop it. If he comes back to them, the chances of them getting a majority to override Obama veto are slim to none. And if I read this correctly, Obama wants this deal, and he doesn't care how bad it is, because he doesn't have to worry about what happens after the deal. He just has to make it and get through the next few months as president. So my question to you is, what does Israel do then?
Well, first of all, you know, I think we might be slightly over pessimistic as to the significance of what happened on Tuesday. Because, I agree with you as far as the legal formalities go, that it would be difficult to stop him. But I think if what you're seeing is a change in mood, a change in political mood, and growing resistance within his party, I'm not sure that he'll be able to push it through. And again, much depends on what Israel does. If Israel were now to send out massive diplomatic forces to the Hill, and lobby congressman after congressman after congressman, or whether it just sits back and hopes for the best, the two different scenarios completely. I mean, I don't think that this is a divinely ordained outcome. I think what we're seeing is a distinct change in political mood. You see articles being written by former Obama supporters were very, very critical of him. So I wouldn't belittle the importance of what has happened. Now, as far as what Israel does, you know, I feel a bit uncomfortable answering that question, because you need to know two things to give a really authoritative answer. And if you know them, you can't really talk about them, because you need to know, A, what Israel's true operational capabilities are. And my feeling is that Israel has far more destructive capability than people normally estimate. And B, you have to know what operational intelligence it has, if it can actually target the correct sites. Because I think that Israel would have to react. But then, you know, I'm not sure that that Israeli leadership has the anatomical appendages to do that. It's a big decision, because once Iran acquires nuclear capability, it's a whole new ballgame. Even if they don't use it, you know, they could spread a nuclear umbrella over its proxy terrorist organizations, who could more or less operate with impunity, because it would be very difficult to deter them with the threat of retaliation, because you'd have a nuclear threat hanging over your head. Ehud Barak, the former Minister of Defense from the Labour Party, has been urging Bibi to launch a strike, and urging the Americans to launch a strike as well, because the alternative is not really war.
Right, I agree with that.
The alternative is a strategic strike against Iran and deterring them from the fallout. In other words, saying we're going to strike your nuclear facilities, we're going to bomb them back 10, 15 years, and if you launch a worldwide terror campaign against us, we will bomb your dams, then we will bomb your bridges, then we will bomb your cities, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know...
Now, I so agree with you on that, and I think it's very... That's another odd thing in the American press. That's just not something that's written. That's just not something that's explored. It's black and white. It's this way or it's that way, and there is a middle ground. And it'd be very interesting to see what happens, just how hard line they get in this next couple of months, what comes out of the Obama administration on this. I think that'll be absolutely, utterly fascinating as to how hard he is on wanting this deal versus taking the options. Because it seems to me, if you do what you say, which is strategic bombing, and you keep those the things intact, you know, so they have no money coming in. That seems pretty powerful to me, and is a better solution, with the hope that you have a better administration regime to work with in Iran. Yes?
I think the difference there between Iran and, say, North Korea is that in Iran you have a feasible opposition.
Right.
There is an opposition. In North Korea there's no real political opposition at all, as far as I understand.
But Obama showed his...
In Iran, there
right.
certainly is.
And Obama showed his card, though.
An effective challenge to the current regime.
I'm sorry to interrupt. What I was going to say was that I think it's interesting that Obama had the chance to work with that opposition, with the students, and he didn't. And I thought that was very telling at the time as well. There's another part that I want to throw into this, into the Iran argument, and that's Hillary Rodham Clinton. Because what she does and what she says in the coming weeks on the issue of Iran will have some effect on how much a risk Obama's willing to take. You agree?
Probably.
She holds a lot of power in this.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see how her Jewish benefactors press her on this issue.
Well, she's got some real interesting Jewish ties going on her right now. It'd be interesting to see how she juggles it all. I got to move on because we only have a second or two left, but I want to ask you two things. One is, American Jews, are you completely flummoxed by the Jewish left?
Well, I think you know, history is going to judge them very harshly. I think the American Jews have betrayed Israel. And I think in a broader sense, they've actually betrayed America in the sense of what America used to be. I think there's very little way that you can reconcile the kind of policies that Obama has embarked upon, embracing enemies and alienating his allies, that is anywhere reminiscent of what America used to be and what made America so great and what gave the Jews such great opportunity in America. I think their blind loyalty to Obama has betrayed certainly Israel and in many ways even America. I think that history will judge them very harshly.
My last question is this: is it time for Israel to wean itself from America?
Well, you know, it depends what you mean by wean. I wrote an article, I think, in 1999, saying that Israel needs to diversify its sources of strategic support. And that's not an easy thing to do. You know, I've been pushing for a long time for closer strategic ties with India. I think that's basically the main alternative to American support. But it's not really all that easy to wean itself. I think Israel should, in many ways, reinvent itself vis-a-vis America. Instead of making itself look as an American client, it should basically be an American partner. Because, you know, if you read books like The Israel Test and listen to some of the talks that Yoram Ettinger, it really is a two-way relationship. America derives billions of dollars of benefits from its ties with Israel. You know, Israeli investments, Israeli inventions, Israeli on the NASDAQ. It's not really a client a patron client relationship. So I think Israel should definitely seek other sources of strategic support. I think the prime alternative would be India, especially given the importance of the Indian Ocean and Israel's growing submarine fleet and second strike capability. But I think Israel needs another strategic option. It's not that easy to see one in the offing at the moment. But I also say, as I said, it should reinvent itself vis-a-vis America. Rather than being a dependent client, it should become a proud partner. And by the way, most of the American aid, especially the military aid that remains in dollars, flows straight back into into the American economy. Because what do they do with the dollars they get from American aid? They buy American equipment, which keeps jobs for American workers and keeps American factories going, et cetera, et cetera. So in many ways, all the dollar-dominated aid that Israel gets is in economic terms a subsidy for American industry. And in many ways, people should be made aware of this.
I've been speaking with Dr. Martin Sherman, columnist for the Jerusalem Post and creator of the Israel Institute of Strategic Studies. For more information on Dr. Sherman, visit his website at www.martinsherman.net. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at Hallie Kasser-Jane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.